Since 1977, we at the seminary have been blessed with Reverend Richard Resch's extraordinary talents as he has served us as our cantor, our leader of the church's song in Cramer Chapel. He is the founder and director of the highly acclaimed Seminary Cantorai, a select men's choir that tours and records extensively. Reverend Resch is a graduate of Valparaiso University with a Bachelor of Music in Organ and Church Music, and he received a master's degree in organ from the Eastman School of Music. His theological education has been here, where he earned the degree Master of Divinity. Cantor Resch is a frequent lecturer and recitalist throughout the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. It gives me great pleasure introducing my colleague and friend, Richard Resch.
Thank you, Dean Reuning. We're all indebted to this man for setting and maintaining the high musical and liturgical standards that we have come to know as the norm for this campus. And all of this has not just happened without effort. So I want to take this public opportunity to thank you. It is a high honor for me to be on the same program with John Kleinig. It is a high honor also to be able to address this gathering with a subject that I teach, work with daily, and care about deeply, and that is hymnody as teacher of the faith. I have made available sheets of examples, mostly of the longer quotes, that I will refer to throughout my paper. Hymns are teachers. Hymns are teachers. That's my theme. In each period of church history, the great minds have commented on this subject, and often their words have included caution. The teaching influence of hymnody is important because more often than we might realize or like to admit, both young and old learn about matters such as theology through the texts they sing. St. John Chrysostom said, "When God saw that the majority of men were slothful and that they approached spiritual reading with reluctance and submitted to the effort involved without pleasure, wishing to make the task more agreeable and to relieve the sense of laboriousness, he mixed melody with prophecy, so that enticed by the rhythm and melody, all might raise sacred hymns to him with great eagerness. For nothing so arouses the soul, gives it wing, sets it free from the earth, releases it from the prison of the body, teaches it to love wisdom and to condemn all things of this life, as concordant melody and sacred song composed in rhythm." And St. Basil the Great adds, "Now the prophets teach certain things, the historians and law teach others, and Proverbs provides still a different sort of advice. But the Book of Psalms encompasses the benefit of them all. It foretells what is to come and memorializes history. It legislates for life, gives advice on practical matters, and serves in general as a repository of good teachings. The Spirit mixed sweetness of melody with doctrine, so that inadvertently we would absorb the benefit of the words through gentleness and ease of hearing. Oh, the wise invention of the teacher who contrives that in our singing we learn what is profitable and that thereby doctrine is somehow more deeply impressed upon our souls." Basil is telling what a hymn is according to God's model, the psalm. Such singing is not a mindless activity. It is rather an activity that teaches the mind. Luther said, when setting forth their theology, the prophets did it not as geometry, not as arithmetic, not as astronomy, but as music, so that they held theology and music most tightly connected and proclaimed the truth through psalms and songs. Now, obviously, hymns will teach truth to hearts and minds if it is truth that is being sung. But because of the inherent appeal and power of music itself, texts carried by music have frequently been used throughout the history of the church as a teacher of all things, some of which are clearly the antithesis of truth. For example, we learn from Athanasius that Arius used songs, specifically one called Thalia, to carry his heretical teaching concerning the nature of Christ to the people. And Tertullian speaks words of caution concerning two very different types of psalms. The psalms also come to our aid, not the psalms of that apostate, heretic, Platonist Valentinus, but those of the most holy and illustrious prophet David. He sings among us of Christ, and through him Christ indeed sang of himself. And centuries later, Luther comments on what has happened to the church's song under the papacy. And he says, there are splendid, beautiful songs and music, but these are used to adorn all sorts of impure and idolatrous texts. Therefore, we have unclothed these idolatrous, lifeless, and foolish texts and divested them of their beautiful music. And we have put this music on the living and holy Word of God in order to sing and praise and honor it. We want the beautiful art of music to be properly used to serve her dear Creator and his creations, his Christians. He is thereby praised and honored, and we are made better and stronger in faith when his holy word is impressed on our hearts by music. Then, 300 years later, Samuel S. Schmucker returns to the impure and idolatrous foolish texts and also leaves behind the churchly music that Luther holds high in favor of any popular form of the day, including even the songs of tent meanings. Here is one of many such hymn texts included in the General Synod Hymnal of 1832 that teaches decision theology. Today, if you will hear his voice, now is the time to make your choice. Say, will you be forever blessed and with the glorious Jesus rest? Behold, he's waiting at your door. Make now your choice. Oh, halt no more. Say, sinner, say, what will you do? Say, will you have this Christ or no? And this is another example from the same Lutheran hymnal that is not only not Lutheran, it's not Christian. My former hopes are fled. My terror now begins. I feel, alas, that I am dead in trespasses and sins. Ah, whither shall I fly? I hear the thunder roar. The law proclaims destruction nigh and vengeance at the door. When I review my ways, I dread impending doom. But sure a friendly whisper says, flee from the wrath to come. I see or think I see a glimmering from afar, a beam of day that shines for me to save me from despair. Forerunner of the sun, it marks the pilgrim's way. I'll gaze upon it while I run and watch the rising day. Now the singing sinner is left to identify the glimmering and the beam that he thinks he sees. The church song here is teaching the sinner about despair and missing the opportunity to teach about the Lord of the cross who has dealt with man's despair. Of what good is it for the Christian or the non-Christian to sing such a text? And now, 150 years after Schmucker, much of the church seems willing to give up anything for the sake of numerical growth, even if it is at the expense, which it usually is, of spiritual growth. Surveys become respected tools that discover what hymns people want to sing. And since most of those hymns are not in Lutheran hymnals, the church must look elsewhere. According to Dave Anderson, the most popular book that meets this need for Missouri Synod is his own 1984, The Other Songbook. Now, it is difficult to consider this songbook as a hymnal in the traditional sense until you realize that it is being used as such. And people are learning from it. Now, what are they learning? Now, as with Schmucker's hymnal, one hardly knows where to begin. Whole discourses could be written on the teaching influences of these collections. Much of the Anderson book is about experiential religion. Immediate revelation is taught in He Walks With Me and He Talks With Me. Religion by feeling in these examples. Let us feel His love begun. Oh, let us feel His presence. Feel the oneness that He brings. Feel the faith swell up inside you. Synergism, blatant and subtle, appears throughout. I have decided to follow Jesus. Accept Him with your whole heart. Ooh, ooh, ooh. If you want joy, you must jump for it. If you want joy, you must sing for it. And if you want joy, you must shout for it. Majesty and praise, mantra-like texts round out this book, where the individual, the congregation, and even a synod is encouraged to feast on the theology of glory. Music as teacher seems so harmless. Words dressed up with notes seem to take on an innocence. But it is a deceptive innocence that over the years has often been an enemy within. The devil is the great deceiver, and it is obvious to anyone who looks carefully that one of his favorite disguises is in the innocence of the church's singing. The guardians from false doctrine who can spot an error miles away in teaching, preaching, and writing have not always been watchful over the church's sung confession. Pastors and parents are part of that guardian group who have heard children singing without listening to their words. Now, these are people who care deeply about what the child grows up believing, but they don't make the connection that the song is teacher of belief. This is most evident in the church's double standard exemplified in Vacation Bible School, Sunday School, and all too often even the parochial school. Well, what are children learning today from songs about their faith? Could it be that most pastors have no idea? With so much on his mind that seems of greater importance, he willingly gives this kind of responsibility to anyone who will accept it. Music leaders pressed into service without guidance often choose their material by the response it will get following two rules. One, children must be able to learn it and love it immediately. And two, parents should see that their children are enjoying themselves. And to accomplish these ends, leaders turn to sources other than the official hymnals of the church. Now, this describes a missed opportunity to teach a true understanding of who we are and what we are about as Lutherans to the age group most open to learning. The teaching of our ethos does not start as adults, and yet we often wait until our members are adults before we treat the hymnal seriously. We give very young children songs that are mostly first article, irreverent, throwaway ditties. We give teenagers yet a different song based on whatever the informal musical trend is of the decade, all of which has nothing to do with the Lutheran prayer book. And because of what we give them, children learn about a church that's quite different from the one we hope they will call their own and be comfortable in as adults. Catechesis has its beginnings in the sung truths of those members of the flock who are just learning to walk. The greatest minds in church history have told us this. But the church, especially in recent times, is reluctant to acknowledge this fact. And as a result, the church song is teaching whatever is easy and popular, with little or no regard for the content or long-term consequences. Also overlooked is the responsibility we have as pastors, teachers, and parents to teach during the years when children are most open to learning such matters. It is easier to teach liturgy and hymnody to children before they reach the sixth grade than it is to teach it to any other age group in the church. Now, matters of worth are not learned without effort. And if a child sees a teacher loving and holding high a subject, the child will work. No matter how much effort it takes to learn what that teacher cares about so deeply. But the problem is that children rarely see their teachers holding such matters high. Children know, they know, when they are being included in the important and sacred things. And they also know that when adults treat sacred matters lightly in their presence, but then have a very different standard for themselves. When pastors teach these matters as a part of confirmation, they are often frustrated by the response of apathy or perhaps outright rebellion. The pastor may not realize something that is clear to the whole class. All of a sudden, the church is doing a turnabout. Now there's a seriousness about a subject that has been fun and games for as long as they can remember. This is the double standard trying to make the transition. And I find it interesting and telling that those who argue for this musical double standard in the church never get around to discussing how and if a transition can be made from the enticing standard to the substantive standard. And that is because it is difficult to defend such things when the starting point is a misrepresentation and is false. Now, youth are saying, by their apathetic response in class, that the church has chosen the most awkward time in their life to get serious about such matters. This is when they are most self-conscious about the use of their voice in any kind of public singing. This is when they are most aware of how their peers view them. This is past the age when they will freely join in and learn whatever the teacher loves. But the main unspoken reason is that long ago they started to form their own opinions about these matters based on what they thought their church was about. But now their pastor is telling them something quite different. To put it another way, Missouri Synod's wait until confirmation age to teach worship practice does not just affect hymnody and liturgy. It concerns the teaching of the faith. Pastors may have to change a child's theology from what has been learned from within the walls of the church. Now, this is a most awkward business and has many fine pastors puzzled about the source of so much foreign theology in their parish. They see evidence of it in all age groups, and they can't understand where it is coming from because these people are in church every Sunday. The mystery of the source of foreign theology throughout the parish is often easily solved by a look at all of the music in a person's life. A growing segment of today's secular world is concerned about the teaching power of texts carried by music. But even in that realm, the cause is not a popular one, because it's against the flow of the times and the masses, and it deals with something that most people want to believe is harmless. Alan Bloom has warned in his book, The Closing of the American Mind, that the music of our time is one of the most powerful teachers of our time. And he zeroes in on a most serious aspect of the problem when he says that the major authority figures in a child's life have no idea what children are learning from the music in their life. In many cases, it is being piped directly to the child's brain quite privately by means of the Walkman. Now, the concern in the secular world about these matters is without a doubt well-founded. What is sad and quite incredible is that in the church, where the teaching influence is of the greatest importance, there is either silence or a quiet acceptance. In fact, concerning this subject, the church is not just in neutral, but many believe she's in reverse with her foot to the floor. It would appear that she no longer believes that her practice teaches. Prosper of Aquitaine, Luther, Walther, Sassa cautioned the church about this from their own century. Lex orandi, lex credendi, that is, the practice of the church teaches the church, was their cry. And Wilhelm Leia said in his three books about the church that the true faith is expressed not only in the sermon, but is also prayed in the prayers and sung in the hymns. He said that through the church's practice, people learn without even noticing it. And in this way, the practice of the church serves the church as a holy weapon of defense and offense in the Lord's battles. Prayer books or hymnals are living books of proof and instruction, according to Leah. We are ignoring the lessons of history, the wisdom of the church fathers, and an important part of the commission of our Lord to teach all things whatsoever I have commanded you. When we allow our practice to misrepresent us. One of the main ways that Lutherans are being misrepresented is through theology of glory hymnody. Now, Hermann Sasse calls this theology the prevailing theology of Christendom. And he warns that today we have a gospel that men fashion for themselves. The sad result is that the theology of the cross, which by its nature has always been a mystery to the world, is becoming more and more of a mystery to the church, even the Lutheran church. The profoundly beautiful, yet puzzling wisdom of the cross is not the main preaching and teaching in the church. Instead, it appears as if the church is choosing the easy route, and clearly the cross has never been the easy route. According to Luther, these two opposite and opposing theologies are no less than a matter of true and false theology. Well, if the theology of glory is the dominant theology among us, and if both true and false theology can be taught quite effortlessly and effectively through hymns, then it follows that it would be wise for all in the body of Christ to pay close attention to how the faith is being taught through the sung word. I propose a very simple two-part hymn practice plan. It's not new, but it may seem new because of how far our worship practice has strayed from the basics. It is a plan in which our sung confession will be consistent with our spoken and written confession. One, use our hymnals. And two, teach our hymnals. Part one, use our hymnals. There's a relatively recent movement toward a weekly, fresh, creative approach to worship. It is often an attempt to avoid being labeled a church on automatic, whose worship is dull and in a rut. And the movement is encouraged by a popular Concordia Publishing House resource with the theologically bankrupt title of Creative Worship. In the parishes where this movement is alive, all manner of weekly creativity gives the impression that someone is hard at work keeping worship alive. As well as denying who is truly at work and the creative one in our worship, and that is the real presence, the chief shepherd, not the under-shepherd and his staff. This movement sends worship leaders scurrying about weekly to any resource that will accomplish crowd-pleasing feats. The bottom line for this ongoing creative compilation is not what is being taught, but how it is being received. A wise old professor once said to me, never speak of challenging people when you are planning worship. Because every minute of earthly life holds some kind of challenge, and the last thing people need is to have someone with a private agenda deciding how they will be challenged when they come to be fed by their Lord. For the sake of the person in the pew, it would be good if more of today's students of theology and church music heard such sound pastoral advice and took it to heart. A stable worship practice is needed now more than ever. But it could very well be the last item most worship leaders would give even a moment's consideration in the 80s and the 90s, because voices everywhere are asking for just the opposite. It is interesting that while Lutheran hymnody and liturgy is somewhat difficult to learn, as are most things of worth, it is far more difficult for the person in the pew to learn new material every time they come to the pew. And the sad result of this movement is that people are not learning anything. For the sake of freshness, the memory is not allowed to function. This ignores the fact that the church has always learned by rote, through a week after week and year after year practice that taught the memory of the faithful. If hymnals unite a church in practice and belief, what does it mean for a church body where increasingly the hymnals of that body sit untouched in the pews? What does it mean when all of the congregational singing comes from a printed bulletin and songs from supplemental books? It means that eventually unity, practice, and belief suffer. And we don't have to wait long or look far to see evidence of this in our church. 20 years ago, it would not have been necessary to defend or encourage, even talk about, the use of Lutheran hymnals in the Lutheran church. However, several developments have changed the status and the use of our hymnals since that time, and I've just listed six here. The first: the use of three hymnals within Missouri Synod since 1978. The Lutheran hymnal with a 32% usage. Lutheran Book of Worship with a 7.9% usage. And Lutheran Worship with a 49% usage. Split the Synod three ways and opened the door for yet further division in prayer books and practice. The source for those figures is the summer 1991 Concordia Publishing House survey results. The second development: that same survey revealed that the use of supplemental hymnals makes up the remaining 11% within our synod. This percentage figure represents a supplemental hymnal as the most frequently used hymnal in that parish. Now, this figure is up an alarming 8.6% from the 1989 survey, and this all translates into approximately 250 parishes per year leaving Lutheran hymnals. The third development: the computer and the in-house copy machines have turned the local parish into its own publishing house that unfortunately does not have a doctrinal review board. Fourth development: recent programs from sources that market the church blatantly place hymns and all church music into the realm of entertainment and manipulation. Cantor Paul Westermeyer of Northwestern Seminary writes, "I expect that the vision of the church as Disneyland and entertainment will increase over the next years because this perspective is being argued not only from the television evangelists, but also from leaders of large and successful mainline churches. The fifth development. It's a well-known fact that the church, that much of the church growth movement, calls Lutheran hymnals a barrier to growth. The hymnals are too heavy literally, and the hymns are too heavy doctrinally. And there is a fear that people will not return because the music is not user-friendly. The sixth development. We are surrounded by the music of evangelicalism. It is teaching through radio stations, concerts, CDs, TV, Walkmans. It's teaching an ethos foreign to that of Lutheranism and its hymnals. And for many Lutherans, this is the main teacher of matters spiritual outside of the worship hour. Therefore, it is wise for pastors and musicians to teach the Lutheran faith through a consistent Lutheran practice from Lutheran hymnals. At least our hymnals do not get caught up in the trends of the times and the whims of the individual leader. They are flawed. But for the most part, they're trusty collections of what has served our confession well. They represent the bringing together of solid examples of theological, musical, and poetic expression from the past and the present that fits us. It is important that we are all confessing and learning the same thing, and that is why I plead with you to stay with our Lutheran hymnals. The second part, teach these hymnals. We've already spoken about the importance of teaching Lutheran ethos to the young, but allow me to add a few points. There was a time not too long ago when pastors had all of the teachers in their parochial school on their side in such matters. I'm afraid that that is history. There also was a time not too long ago when pastors could count on their Lutheran musicians to be the best teachers of Lutheran practice. Now, that is still the case in some parishes, but that too is on the decline. A pastor may find himself all alone in his conviction of lex orandi, lex credendi. Alone at first, perhaps, but as he daily and consistently imparts this through every aspect of his pastoral practice, people will see worship at the very center of the church's life and worship practice as a beautiful and painless teacher of the faith. All pastors make decisions on a weekly basis about what will be used from the hymnal. However, when the hymnal becomes an integral part of pastoral practice, the weekly decisions become daily decisions. Decisions that reflect careful thought as to what is being proclaimed by a hymn in school chapel or a short liturgy at bedside. Decisions that always take into account where the church is in her progression through the church year. And decisions that consistently treat the hymn as teacher of the faith, even for the shortest devotion before a meeting. Next to the catechism, the hymnal has traditionally been the book that has taught the faith. It has done that by teaching the practice by putting doctrine into a hymnic form that's understood by everyone and then is memorized through repeated use. The hymn is then in a form that applies doctrine to lives. And until recently, the faithful treasured their hymnal as a main devotional resource. And through regular, perhaps daily use, they often memorized more from their hymnal than they did from the Bible. It was the Lutheran prayer book. It was one of the main teachers of what it meant to be Lutheran. Well, there seems to be a reluctance on the part of many worship leaders to let people open their Lutheran prayer book in worship. The increasingly common practice of printing all hymn texts in the service folder is one that leaves the hymnal sitting in the pew rack untouched and unlearned. Worshippers cannot learn to love a hymnal that they never open. Now, the printing of liturgies can be justified, but the printing of hymns that could be sung from the hymnal cannot. The faithful learn their way around their prayer book by using it. Then they are more likely to turn to it in times of need, in times of rejoicing, and it serves them in their public and their private devotional life. So the very first simple way to teach our hymnals is by letting our people use the book. Second way is to teach but one hymnal per parish. The practice of having different hymnals for the very young, for teenagers, for singles groups, for nursing homes, for home circle groups, for alternate contemporary services, to name a few, is a great pedagogical mistake, and it is also potentially divisive. Who is overseeing all of these sung confessions? And what does the use of everything but the main hymnal in the parish life say about the main hymnal? Furthermore, pre-service sing-alongs of hymns you like to sing from hymnals with similar names is an apology to visitors and members for the Lutheran hymnal practice that will follow. Now, a third way to teach the hymnal is to encourage its use in the home. Now, here Concordia Publishing House has a fine new resource, and I have listed that on your example sheet, and they just sent a box of about 200 samples today for you to take home with you. It's out on your way out. At home in our hymnal. And this introduces a concept to families that shows them how to make use of the vast resource right in our hymnal on a daily basis in the home. Eventually, this could lead to all family members having their own personal copy of the hymnal, which they use daily and bring with them to corporate worship. Families could also help each other to learn the hymnal by the use of a pointing, helping finger in a young child's hymnal that guides them through worship. This type of suggestion from the pastor goes a long way toward changing attitudes and practice. The fourth way to teach these matters is to make certain that all the leaders in your parish understand that the hymn is a teacher of doctrine and a preacher of the word. This sets it apart from the common status it has as a highly pleasurable but insignificant filler that is inserted on the way to something important. A kerygma didache understanding on the part of these key people in the life of the parish is crucial. This will make the practice of the parish consistent with what comes from the pulpit. That application of lex orandi, lex credendi knows no age limit. Very young children are able to learn bits and pieces of what we hope will be their prayer book for the rest of their lives. In fact, the prime time to start a Lutheran ethos foundation is those early years. And problems of standards concerning what will be taught has little or nothing to do with the children. It is and always has been a problem of adults not understanding the long-term teaching influence of their leadership role. The fifth way to teach our hymns and the hymnal is to enlist the efforts of the main teacher in the parish for such matters.